Ahead and open your Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 1. Nehemiah chapter 1. We're looking at Nehemiah chapters 1 and 2. Tonight, now I have just a word to say about the book of Nehemiah itself here in just a moment. But I'll tell you, I've probably progressed to, well, what's going on here? I've probably progressed to Nehemiah chapter 8 or 9 in just my preparation for the class. And I tell you, I've been really impressed. I've never done much more than just the most basic study for the book of Nehemiah. And so just as I've come to look at him and some of the things that he's done, particularly when we get into the rebuilding of the wall, I tell you, he is a rather impressive figure and a great example in many ways. So I've just thoroughly enjoyed the study, and I'm looking forward to being able to share some of those things with you and hopefully to learn some things from you as well in the course of our study. So just a couple of words by way of introduction, and I don't have this on the screen, but the book of Ezra was largely about the rebuilding of the temple. That was the focal point, the rebuilding of the temple, and then Ezra dealing with the spiritual degradation of Israel whenever he arrived to find out that intermarriage had taken place among the leadership, and it trickled down to the people. And so the book kind of ends with them making this covenant with God, putting away their foreign wives, and asking God to bless them once again. Okay, and so it's kind of in between this period of maybe spiritual revival. As we're going to see, Nehemiah is going to come along a little bit later, and they're going to kind of slunk back down to some of the old practices. And so there's going to be a need for being stirred up again spiritually. There are three major events that take place in this book. In chapters 1 through 6, we have the rebuilding of the wall. That's the big thing that takes place in the first six chapters. Chapters 7 through 10, he's going to deal with revival and renewal. Okay, and as I said, Israel had slunk into some of their sins of the past, and he's going to kind of revive them and get them going back on track where they need to be spiritually. And then chapters 11 through 13 is going to deal with the resettlement of Jerusalem. Now, just a thought about this. The book of Nehemiah is believed to have been written by Ezra. And while they're two separate books, Ezra and Nehemiah, in our Bibles, in the Jewish Bibles, they were combined to make a single book. So they were all on a single scroll, Ezra and Nehemiah being compiled and kept together. So that has no bearing really on anything aside from the fact that you see that thematically they're very, very closely related. And there are some overlap in between the characters that we'll find Ezra being the primary character that's both in the book of Ezra and will make an appearance later in the book of Nehemiah. The book of Nehemiah, the events of chapter 1 occur about 13 years after Ezra's return. So Ezra's been there for about 13 years. He's teaching the people. He's reestablishing them spiritually. And this is about 70 years after the temple has been completed. So a pretty significant period of time has taken place in between the completion of the temple and Nehemiah's return to Jerusalem. Almost two generations worth. All right, with that being said, let's just get into our study in Nehemiah chapter 1. Tommy, would you read for us Nehemiah 1 verses 1 through 3, please? All right, so this is just kind of an introduction to the book, an introduction to the time period of when these events are going to be taking place, and an introduction to the primary character, that is Nehemiah. So it's said that this is taking place, these events are taking place in the 20th year of the reign of Artaxerxes. We talked about Artaxerxes a good bit in the book of Ezra. So that's kind of the time frame in which we're working, and that's why we're able to say this is about where we think the book of Nehemiah takes place. So we're able to date it based off of other events, which, like most Bible writers, They'll date them to the reign of a particular monarch or a particular king. And so, obviously, the story of the Bible is taking place alongside history, and so we're able to have an understanding of when these events are taking place. So it's the 20th year of the reign of Artaxerxes. It's in the month of Chislev, which is November to December, if you put it in the calendar year that we work with. And they were said to be in the area of Shushan, or the ESV says Susa. Susa was a winter residence for Persian kings. It would get too hot in the summer for them to be there, so they would only be there during the winter months, but it was a place where they would often reside in the winter months. And you'll also recall Susa probably is the primary location where the events of Esther take place as well. So Esther, as you know, runs somewhere parallel to the events of Ezra and Nehemiah. It's a contemporary, we might say. One of Nehemiah's brothers, Hanani, comes to Ezra from the city of Jerusalem, and some come with him, and he just brings a report as to the status of the city. Okay, and he says that the city is in pretty bad shape. The walls of the city are broken down. The gates have been burned. Nebuchadnezzar, he was the king that destroyed, king of the Babylonians that destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and he made three attacks on it. And there were three groups of Jews that were taken back, and because the Jews were just, he tried to put somebody in place and said, okay, I'll let you have a little autonomy. Just don't cause any trouble. And so they did. The people rebelled, and they killed one of the kings that he had kind of put in place. And so he comes back and he attacks them again, and it says, okay, this is the last chance. And they don't straighten up, so he comes back and he just destroys the city. He destroys the temple. He tears down the walls. He burns up much of the city. And that's really, when we talk about the exile to Babylon, that's the primary attack of Nebuchadnezzar, the third one that resulted with the exile to Babylon. It's where much of the city was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. The temple vessels were taken from Jerusalem to Babylon. And just news is brought to Nehemiah that since the days of Nebuchadnezzar's attack on Jerusalem, the city is still in shambles. And the significant statement being, he said, the walls have not been rebuilt. And we'll talk more about the walls and the significance of their not being up in chapter 2. Let's go ahead and look at verses 4 through 11. Dad, would you read chapter 1, 4 through 11, please? All right, this prayer is rather reminiscent of a couple of prayers that we've heard offered. It's a prayer of repentance. It's a prayer where Nehemiah confesses the sin of his people. They're turning away from God. They're going to idols. And the deservedness of the punishment that the Jews have received. And so it's we're not just going to rehash all of that. One thing that we do want to observe that Nehemiah does is he says, we brought this on ourselves. You told us, and you can go back and you can read in the book of Deuteronomy, where God is listing all of the curses that are going to fall upon the people if they turn away from him and go after idols. It really culminates with, I'm going to send you away, I'm going to kick you out of the promised land, and I'm going to send you off into other nations. But That being said, Nehemiah reminds, as he's praying, reminds God, as if God needs reminding. It's not for that reason, but this is kind of a covenantal prayer that's being offered up, and so he incorporates this in. He says, but you promised that if we repent as a people, and if we turn back to you, then you'll bring us back home. Okay, and that's what the book of Nehemiah is going to largely be about, is the reestablishment and the repopulation of Jerusalem. And so it all begins here with Nehemiah being sorrowful, weeping, praying, fasting, mourning, as he hears the state of the city. And this man, just what he does is so impressive. You know, we get to the Gospels, and we're familiar with the exile and the destruction of Jerusalem, and we're familiar with the Gospels, how Jerusalem has again, in a sense, become a prominent city during the Roman Empire. But it had to be rebuilt. And Nehemiah pretty much takes the bull by the horns, and it's largely due to his work. And as you're going to see, God had put this on his heart. God is going to empower him, and Nehemiah is going to be the vessel that God uses to rebuild and resettle the city of Jerusalem. And so this really paves the way from the exile, which we're quite familiar with, and the Gospels, which we're quite familiar with. Nehemiah and Ezra are two of the main players in getting Jerusalem back to where they needed to be. Because remember, all of this is in preparation, and all of this is with a plan that God has. He's going to bring Jesus. Okay, and so Nehemiah's work in rebuilding the city walls, in rebuilding the inner parts of the city, and seeing that the city is re-inhabited, this is essential for what's going to take place. And he's going to be the vessel that the Lord uses. But I tell you, just as we read through this and see what he does, and you see what he has to put up with, both from the enemies and from even within, you can't help but be impressed with his faith and with his willingness to work. So one of the things you're also going to see as you read through this book, Nehemiah is a man of prayer. Okay, 10 times throughout the book, we're going to see him praying. On 10 occasions, he prays to God. Okay, so it appears that the promise is failing. The people have gone home, but the walls haven't been rebuilt. And I'm just going to skip over this question so we can kind of move on. But he offers this prayer of repentance. And he reminds God of this covenant promise where if the people repent, then you'll bring us back home. Okay, and that's kind of what started, but Nehemiah is going to be the one who is going to aid in this being accomplished. And he closes out the chapter by saying, I was cupbearer to the king. That would have entailed several things. It would have entailed serving the king wine. It also would have entailed being a test taster, because if someone were trying to assassinate the king, poisoning would be a very common method. And so before the king would ever take a drink of the wine, it would first be tested by the cupbearer. And only after it was shown to be safe to drink would the king then drink from it. So we may not think about it, but if you just think about the trust, and we're going to see this when we get into the second chapter, because of Nehemiah's position as cupbearer to the king, there was a great degree of trust between him and between the king. Literally, this man, his job is to lay his life on the line to protect the king. So you're going to see that Nehemiah is a confidant to the king. He's got a great degree of influence. And as you think about Nehemiah's life, and as you think about his relationship to a pagan king, a pagan ruler, it's very akin to what we see God doing with men like Joseph, where he used Joseph to get close to the king, and then through that close relationship accomplish his will. You see him doing that with Daniel as well. You see him doing that with Esther. You see him doing that with Mordecai. And he's going to use Nehemiah very similarly, this close relationship to the king, and he's going to use that to the benefit of his people. Any questions or comments on chapter 1? Dad? You're right. I mean, it's God who providentially directs the affairs of our life. He brings people in. He puts us in places that he wants us to be. He gives us gifts and abilities. He opens doors. But what do we have to do? Well, we've got to be willing to do what Nehemiah does. We've got to be willing to work. We've got to be willing to say, here I am. Lord, send me. you know, I suppose that Nehemiah could have refused to respond to the burden that God put on his heart. That doesn't mean God's will is not going to be done. God would have brought someone else up, but Nehemiah wouldn't have been the one to have been able to offer this service to the Lord. And you're right, it's something good for us to think about. The people that God puts in our life, the positions that God puts us in, the opportunities He gives us, we need to avail ourselves to those opportunities and just to see that God is going to be helping us in that. Good observation. Robert?
I think of the people in Jerusalem, that had to be a pretty sad state over that 100 years or whatever since they returned. You know, with no walls and such a small number, there couldn't have been much of value in that city. There have been raiding groups and things like that.
Yeah.
His heart was certainly troubled by the state of things.
Yes.
In their home country,
yep.
Home city.
And if you've ever read through the Psalms, and you probably have noticed, Jerusalem is a very prominent theme as you read through the Psalms. You may refer to it as Zion. It may refer to the city of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem is a very prominent place. And the obvious reason being, because if you think of all that Jerusalem is, it's really the place where God's house dwells, God's name dwells under the old law. But you're right, the shame. And as we're going to see, there's shame and derision that Jerusalem suffered, and not having the walls was going to put them in a very vulnerable position, like you were saying. And so it really prevents the city from gaining any traction, gaining any growth, or having any sort of appeal that might bring about growth. And Nehemiah is going to take care of that. And so the Lord put a very heavy burden on his heart to get Jerusalem and to see its glory restored. Anybody else?
Nehemiah's prayer kind of lets you see how if you align yourself with God's plan and God's will, much can be accomplished.
Yeah.
Even today.
You're right, absolutely. And we'll make some of those observations as we go along, because that's, like you said, Dick, that's really what the book is about, is aligning yourself with God's plan and God's will. Nehemiah gets right there in the center of God's will, and he's got a willingness to work. And those two things put together, the will of God and a willingness to work of man, are going to make for a powerful combination. Let's see. So let's go ahead and get into chapter 2. Lance, you mind reading for us?
Yep.
Would you read verses 1 through 8, please?
In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you were not ill? This can be nothing but sadness. But sadness of heart. I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors were buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said to me, "What is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city of Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it." Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked, "How long will your journey take, and when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, "If it pleases the king, may I have the letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me safe conduct when I arrive in Judah. And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel. By the timber and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my request."
All right, thank you. So this is about 4 months from when Nehemiah first heard the news. So think about that. He hears the news about Jerusalem. He's fasting, he's praying, he's mourning. That's a long time, about 4 months, all in preparation for this moment. He's bided his time, but the moment has arrived for him to make known his request to the king. Obviously, regardless of whatever personal problems one may be dealing with, the king, those who serve the king and serve in the king's presence are expected to keep their personal feelings hid. You're having a bad day, you better not let it show. For just multiple reasons, you better put on the cheerful countenance in the presence of the king. However, Nehemiah's face is fallen this day as he's serving his master. And since in his sorrow, the king inquires as to what might be wrong. Now, this was a dangerous position to be in. Kings wanted their servants to be happy. If you look sad in the presence of the king, then that reflects poorly on his reign. But not only that, but if you think about the position that Nehemiah served as the king's cupbearer, what's going on with the cupbearer? Why is he acting that way? Is there something going on that I should know about? And so within the king, it could create this suspicion. And the fact that he's concerned is and rather disquieted shows that the trust that the king had for him. And he said, when he realizes Nehemiah's temper and his countenance has fallen, he asks him what's wrong, and Nehemiah's afraid. Okay, he's afraid for multiple reasons. I think his fear probably is greatest because the moment that he's been waiting for has finally arrived. He's about to make this petition to the king if he can go and return to Jerusalem and to rebuild the city walls and the city itself. One of the reasons he might be afraid is because it was Artaxerxes who had ordered a cease and desist for the building of Jerusalem. Okay, we could go back to Ezra chapter 4, verses 17 through 23, and Ezra kind of details how they're starting to rebuild the city. And what Artaxerxes did when he found out about it, he issued an edict and he told the people, stop rebuilding Jerusalem. Here Nehemiah is going to turn to the king who said, stop building Jerusalem, and says, hey, can I go back home and rebuild Jerusalem? So he could be denied. He could be put to death for his insolence, for his request. So obviously, this is the moment he's been waiting for, and so he's fearful as to what might happen. But he tells him, I can't feign happiness. I can't pretend to be happy when the place of my fathers lies in ruins. And so the king says, well, what do you want? And this shows that he has the favor of the king. And one of the key verses being in verse 8, that last statement that was made where it says, the king granted to me what I asked. Why, Nehemiah? For the good hand of my God was upon me. God is working providentially to make things favorable and bring about the favorable outcome that he desires. That's what that phrase, the good hand of my God was upon me. And you see it in the book of Ezra. You see it throughout the course of the book of Nehemiah. This is God's favor bestowed upon them, providentially working things about to accomplish what God's plan is. So, interesting. Before he makes this request, the king says, what's wrong? Verse 4, I've heard sermons preached on this verse, and rightly so. It says, before he answers, after he's asked, in this brief snippet, before he makes his request known, he says, I prayed to the God of heaven. And so it couldn't have been a long prayer. Very, very short, what I like to call it, just an arrow prayer where we just make a request of God. Maybe it's one or two sentences. And so he prays to God to give him favor, and then he makes this request to return to Judah, rebuild the city of his fathers and his own home. Kind of interesting, he doesn't ever call Jerusalem by name. So he just kind of refers to it as the city of his fathers. And Artaxerxes is the king here that's standing before him. And this was brought out in our Ezra study, but I'll remind us of this detail because it could tie in and have some impact into what's going on. Artaxerxes' father was who? Do we remember? Ahasuerus or Xerxes. That was the king who married Esther. And so Esther would have been Artaxerxes' stepmother, in a sense. And so that could have cultivated maybe a little favor for the Jewish people. Maybe, maybe not. But that is a detail that you can't just throw out as being insignificant. All right. I said we'll talk about... Okay? Yeah? Yeah, he was... Yeah, he would have been the, I forget what you call it. He'd have been the right hand man of the king, anyway. So he took Haman's place after Haman his failed attempt to kill the Jews happened. So he wants to go back and rebuild the city walls. Why is it important that the walls be rebuilt? And we kind of alluded to this, but we'll just offer anybody a chance to weigh in on this. Okay. Yeah. You didn't have any walls around the city. You were just saying, you know, come and take my stuff, pretty much. It was walls that kept the city safe. That's when we read about the spies being sent into the land of Israel back in Numbers chapter 13 and 14. What's one of the things that they say? The cities are fortified. The walls around them are all very thick. And you've got Jericho, which that's in Joshua chapter 2 and 6, known for its walls. Walls are what kept the city safe. And if a city didn't have walls, it was defenseless. And I think there's a proverb, a man that has no control of his temper is like a city without walls. I mean, he's just asking to be invaded, asking to be overthrown. So Walls were significant for protection of the people, for protection of the temple. Okay, the temple had been rebuilt, but it's not protected, okay, because there's no walls to the city of Jerusalem. And so the people are defenseless, the temple is defenseless, and the Jews had tried to rebuild it, but a cease and desist had been ordered by the king. So let's go ahead and finish out the chapter. Robert, would you read verses 9 through 20 for us, chapter 2?
Then I came to the governors beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. How far did I go to the end?
Yeah, just through the end of chapter 2.
And I rose in the night, and some of the few men with me, neither told I any man that what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. Neither was there any beast with me, save the beast I rode upon. And I went out by night to the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, and to the dung court, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. Then I went to the gate of the foundation of the king's pool, but there was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the brook, and viewed the wall, and turned back, and entered by the gate of the valley, and so returned. And the rulers knew not whither I went, or what I did. Neither had I as yet told it to the Jews, nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest that did the work. Then I said unto them, ye see the distress that we are now in. How Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. Then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's words that he had spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant the Ammonite and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that you do? Will you rebel against the king? Then I answered them, and I said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will rise and build. But ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem.
All right. Thank you, Robert. So about 3 or 4 months take pass for Nehemiah to prepare. Remember, Ezra doesn't go back with an armed escort. Nehemiah does. So he goes back. He's escorted by the king. He's on an official order from the king to repair the city. And when he gets there, he's going to meet a couple of enemies that we're going to see repeatedly throughout the book. And I don't know. I'm kind of like Robert, just working through these pronunciations on their own. I don't know if this is the right way to say it or not. If it's not, somebody can correct me afterward. Sanballat and Tobiah. I don't know if that's how you say that or not, but that's what I'm talking about, those two guys here. When we read, Sanballat was the governor of Samaria. So Samaria would have been north of Judah, north of Jerusalem. And they worshiped God, but they worshiped other gods as well. So they had kind of stayed true to the worship of the Lord in some ways, but they had also were an amalgamation of the people around them worshiping the false gods as well. Tobiah was the governor of Ammon to the east of the Jordan. His name means the Lord is good, and he likely would have worshipped the God of Israel as well. And as we're going to see, he's closely related to a priest in the city by the name of Eliashib. And then there's another enemy that we meet in verse 19, Geshem, the Arabian. He governed the area to the south. And so what we're seeing is, you're getting the picture, to the north, to the east, to the south. These people were surrounded by enemies, and that's what happens. They're discouraged. As soon as they get back, Tobiah's there, Sanballat's there, and they weren't happy to see anybody seek the good of the Jews. Multiple reasons. One, that would be another political enemy, political competition, but also because the Jews worshipped Yahweh exclusively. And so they would have that right. And you see that exclusivity in verse 20 whenever they're there. Nehemiah says, we're here by order of the king, so don't try to stop us, and don't try to help us. So you see that same exclusivity that you saw in Ezra, where they refused to take any help from the nations around them. So just remember these three guys. Nehemiah goes, he checks out the city, He sees it. It's in pretty bad shape. And then he goes and he tells the people, here's what we're here to do. So they strengthen their hands and they're preparing to rebuild. So next week we'll get into chapters 3 and 4. Chapter 3, on the surface, it seems like a very boring chapter, but I found some very interesting things there. I'm excited to share that with y'all when we start to look at the work and the rebuilding of Jerusalem. So thank you for your participation and your attention tonight in our class. Thank you.